This is the Afternoon Brief on High FM with Michael McKenna. Focused reporting, sharp analysis, and the local stories shaping our lives. Daily updates in a fast-paced world.
When fear becomes politics, understanding xenophobic violence. Now, today, thousands of South Africans are expected to take part in the so-called March on March. This is a nationwide demonstration calling for stronger action against illegal immigration. And while organizers say the protests are about law enforcement and border control, critics fear the demonstrations could inflame anti-immigrant sentiment and potentially lead to xenophobic violence. Now, it does sound familiar. It's a conversation we've had before, often with tragic consequences. Now, what really drives xenophobic violence? Is it really about immigration? Or are there deeper political, economic, social forces at play? Joining us now is Ofentse Donald Davi, a South African political risk and foreign policy analyst and research associate at the Center for Risk Analysis. Just some background to our conversation. In a recent Business Day opinion piece, he explores the political science behind xenophobic violence and why understanding its root causes is essential if our country is to break the silence. Ofentse, good afternoon to you. Welcome back to the show. Great to have you on board once again.
Good afternoon, and thanks for having me. Always good to be back.
Right. So, today we are witnessing the March on March demonstrations around illegal immigration. Now, before we get into the politics of the issue, how should we understand what's happening today?
Yeah, sure. So, today these anti-immigrant movements and groups have called for peaceful protest. And calling for a peaceful protest, nothing wrong with that. Everyone has a right to organize themselves and protest and express their frustrations. And that is what they are calling for. So far, that is what has been happening. And that's okay. In my piece in Business Day, where I explain why xenophobic violence occurs, this frustrations that have built up into these peaceful protests are but a layer as to the reason why things actually do turn violent.
Right. So let's look at your article. You argue that political science, it offers important insights into xenophobic violence. Now, what are we missing when we reduce these incidents to simple hatred of foreigners?
Yeah. So essentially, a common mistake that's made by many people in the public, but also something that the leaders of these violent occurrences spew to their followers, is that the reason why one person should be violent, or the reason why this person is being violent, is because they are frustrated and they are deprived of something, and thus they're expressing their frustrations through violence. This is, in political science, what's called the relative deprivation thesis, meaning that if you have an expected need and an actual need being satisfied, that's okay if it's at a tolerable difference. But if the difference between what you expect and what you receive grows bigger and bigger and bigger, then you may express your frustration into violence. And we see that when looking at South Africa as a whole. Unemployment is on a rise, the delivery of services is down, the living standards are also decreasing. So what we expect and what we get, that gap is widening. And thus, a common mistake that's made is that because that gap is widening, people are going to turn violent. However, that is a mistake that we should not make.
Let's also look at the role of the state before we start to really interrogate the issue. One of the themes also in your article is the role of the state. So how much responsibility then does government carry in either preventing or unintentionally fueling xenophobic tensions?
Yeah, exactly. So a big contributor as to why people turn violent is because they find an incentive to turn violent. It's that if the actual political authorities will not do their job, I'll do it myself, and thus that's a reason for me to turn violent. And that's a key contributor to why these xenophobic violence occurs, because we have seen that the state, as a result of what led up to what we're seeing today, is that the state has not been holding up its end of its promise and its responsibilities of maintaining borders and of policing. It's just basic policing and keeping citizens of all nations in South Africa safe. And thus, as that gap is growing and that frustration is growing of not feeling safe, you're going to find someone to blame. In this case, it's the state that's being blamed. And now the responsibility of the state is being taken over by those that should not be doing it, which is frustrated citizens.
If I can put it this way, the dangers, the concerns of social media and political narratives, this realm, if I can put it that way, of social media has become, you could say, a powerful force in shaping opinions on immigration. Has this perhaps amplified misinformation and heightened tensions for that matter?
So I'd give that a both a yes and a no. So yes, in terms of the misinformation aspect of it, which is that it's now easier to communicate some of the myths that are spread by the people that are organizing these mobilizations, the myths that foreign nationals are invading the country or taking over the township economy. It's easier to communicate those myths. However, the biggest disruption we've seen in xenophobic violence in South Africa was in 2008, where there were nearly 70 deaths and over 100,000 individuals that were displaced. In 2008, that advantage of social media was not there for those that benefit from these episodes. Yet, that was the biggest occurrence of violence we saw. So, although social media plays a big role in spreading the information and misinformation, it doesn't necessarily correlate to an increase in violence.
I'm getting in some interesting questions here, Ofense. The first question reads, says, hi, Ofense. To what extent are unemployment and inequality driving tensions blamed to migrants?
Yeah, so the issue, again, going back to holding the state accountable and also going back to relative deprivation, if people don't have jobs, they're essentially going to look for someone to blame. And that's something important to keep in mind. They're going to look for someone to blame, and thus any person who comes up to that person who may be unemployed and frustrated offers them a solution or a reason as to why they're feeling deprived that can be used to mobilize someone. So a different example is that if someone is unemployed, has been unemployed for a while, and they are frustrated, a politician can approach them and say, vote for me so that you can hold so-and-so accountable, and thus you'd be mobilizing that specific person to go stand in a line and put an X on a ballot next to your name. That's one way to mobilize a frustrated individual. In this case, we are seeing that March and March and Operation Dudula, they're taking that exact same condition and environment and approaching these frustrated individuals. And in this time, they're calling for mobilization at a street level, not at a voting at a ballot. And thus, in turn of that, that's how it can turn violent. Going to a ballot to vote on a piece of paper, there's no way that can turn violent. But protesting in the street while people are holding weapons around you, that can turn to violence.
Ofense, I don't mean this to sound speculative. I mean, one must have, you know, reliable sources and proof as to what one discusses. But just looking at things on the ground, do you think that this particular march could possibly be hijacked for ulterior motives, for ulterior purposes, other than the immigration, the illegal immigrant subject?
Sure. So there's many ways to look at it. And so at a very microscopic level, we may see one or two instances where one person may be hurt or one person may be attacked in an isolated place. Mm-hmm. However, I do not anticipate widespread violence, at least at the scale of what we saw in 2008, or even at the scale of what we saw in July 2021. And the reason for that is because this time around, a deadline was set of the 30th of June, something that our state security has never had before, which is time to prepare. And thus, police have been in preparation for this and have mobilized a lot of resources in preparation, and as well as collaborating with the private sector. As well, on top of that, the organizers of these protesters have been in constant communication with the government. We saw just last night, they were in communication with the President of the Republic. And thus, that's the big difference that we're seeing today is that there's time to prepare and there has been time for diplomacy in essence. Okay. And because of that, it's safe to not assume the worst case scenario may play out.
Sure. Right. So you've mentioned now, as I noted earlier on in articles, where the president did meet with march organizers on that basis. Now, if government then wants to address both illegal immigration and public frustration, then for that matter, what should a responsible response then look like?
Yeah, so in this instance, in terms of immigration, whatever the state does in terms of its immigration law enforcement, it'll never satisfy the crowd at hand. Our deportation numbers in 2007 to be specific, were nearly double, or nearly six times actually, the number of deportations we experienced last year. And yet in 2008, we saw the biggest occurrence of violence, of xenophobic violence. And thus immigration law and the enforcement of that won't satisfy those that are frustrated and that are being mobilized. But what will do that is if the government can actually make some improvements in economic growth, in creating jobs, in policing, because those frustrations, going back to relative deprivation, those frustrations are the foundation of why we see xenophobic violence occurs. If that foundation is eliminated, if everyone has a job and if everyone feels safe when they're walking on the streets, whether there is an illegal immigrant around you or not, you won't care enough to the point that you mobilize and turn violent. And that's what the state can do, which is to do what everyone else has been asking for, not just those that are protesting, which is to grow the economy, create jobs, and make our streets safer.
Okay, so let's look specifically at today's demonstrations. What should we be watching for over the coming days? What can we anticipate?
So the key thing to watch out for is the policing capacity. If policing, or rather if there is no visible policing and policing starts to become overwhelmed by the number of protesters, the protesters will again find an incentive to turn violent, because though the state ought to hold the monopoly of violence. And if that monopoly is being exposed, and if the protesters are holding more potential violence, they will act on that potential violence and turn violent. So police invisibility is something to look out for. Mm-hmm. If police invisibility starts to decline at near the end of the day and even moving on to tomorrow and the rest of the week, then there may be a worst case scenario panning out. But until then, policing hasn't been interrupted, it hasn't been overwhelmed, and thus at the moment, as we are seeing things play out, it's safe to assume that the worst case scenario won't play out. But just look out for policing capacity.
Well, Fensi, as we begin to wrap up our conversation today, if there's finally one message you'd like to give to us South Africans to take away from your article, what would that be and why?
So the one message I'd like to share is that let's rather not scapegoat. The issues at hand are issues that we are all suffering from. And it's not only poor people that are protesting and rich people that are at home. The socioeconomic status of it plays no role, because we are all experiencing the same macro level issues of unemployment, highest poverty rate, inequality, so on and so forth. Hold the leaders responsible for that accountable rather than scapegoating our neighbors.
Questions to you. Do you believe illegal immigration is the root cause of local community frustration? And what do you think would reduce tensions in communities most affected? Are economic hardships, for that matter, being wrongly redirected towards foreign nationals? Ofense, it's been a pleasure having you on board the show once again. And thanks so much for your input and your, analysis of what's led to today's march and march demonstrations. Ofense Donald Dovey, a South African political risk and foreign policy analyst and research associate at the Center for Risk Analysis. And as the demonstrations unfold, it's important to remember that whilst every country has the right to enforce its immigration laws, the way we have these conversations matter. Strong institutions, evidence-based policy, and responsible political leadership far more likely to solve these challenges than fear or division. I am noting some updates happening on a platform which I'm observing right now. Live updates happening. Tensions are rising in Pretoria as anti-illegal immigration protest gathers momentum. Also, police arrest looters as nationwide protests remain mostly peaceful. Ongoing protests in South Africa. Updates from major cities. Okay, a Limpopo farm owner also arrested alongside 15 undocumented workers in an immigration crackdown and foreign-run shops shut as Hansbaai stays calm. This update in Gauteng, Waterval Road Benoni has been closed due to protest action. Motorists are advised to avoid the area where possible and make use of alternative routes.